There
Welcome
should be more
everybody
people
to
here. Nobody else has anything to do. They're all stuck inside from the coronavirus.
Exactly. You'd think that coronavirus quarantines have got to help with open source contributions. That's the thank you for joining. This is the Aries Working Group A call on March 11th. We got a number of things to discuss. We might go light on the work updates. Mike has prepared an RFC to propose a revised architecture, a new architecture for the Aries Key Management Service. And we want to spend the bulk of our time on that. But in January, February, sometime fairly recently, Evernim built a connection reuse functionality for one of our customers using the old Evernim protocols, so not the new Aries protocols. And we contributed that back in libvcx, which has both the Evernim old protocols and the new protocols. And we promised when we contributed back, we said, we really should create an RFC so people know what we're doing. And we never got it done. And Steven did the out-of-band RFC in the Aries Working Group call. Anybody who isn't familiar with that, you should go back and look at the recording from, I think it was from the 4th. No, it was from the week before, from the 26th. And that really said, oh, wait, Steven's thought about solving the same problem in a different way. So we need to make sure that we recognize when we did this without doing an RFC first that there'd be some rework as we moved into a common community approach. But Steven asked us to make sure to share what we were doing so that we have those ideas as we discuss the out-of-band protocol. So we want to take some time to do that today. To cram that in means we got to cut work updates a little short. But we'll try and keep that discussion fairly short so it doesn't cut in too much to Mike's time. Any other topics we need to cover today? Okay, I see people have started adding themselves to the attendee list, which is great. Makes it much easier to track what's going on, who attended which meeting. I'd like to give welcomes to everybody. I'm not very good at this. We want to make sure to carve time out every one of these calls and let people introduce themselves. You don't have to introduce yourself, but if you're new, then we'd love to get to know you and understand your use case for Aries and your intentions for the call, so we make sure to meet your needs. Anybody new on the call want to introduce yourself? Darko, you came off mute for a minute, but I didn't hear you talk. Did you want to introduce yourself?
No, I have some problems with my computer, so I'm trying to connect, but while I'm online, I may try to introduce. I'm Darko Kulic. I'm a developer from Evernim. I work at some time in the SDK, especially on the wallet project. And now I work on some other projects for Evernim, but from time to time I have some commits for in the SDK.
Yep. Thank you, Darko. Darko has attended these calls in the past, but he only attends now and then. He is the one that originally wrote the Evernim approach to connection reuse. So we're really glad you're able to join after Stephen made the request to learn more about it. Anybody else want to introduce yourselves?
Hey everyone, this is Ashish. I'm a blockchain developer and I am interested in learning more about the Hyperledger Aries project around DID-based verifiable credentials and key management. So that's why I'm joining this call.
Excellent. Thank you for joining. Have you used Aries before?
No. I'm just starting to look into this.
Very good. Well, welcome. We're excited you're joining us. The resource I like to tell everybody about is ssimeetup.org. If you're new to the ecosystem, there's about 40 different webinars on here that go through all aspects of self-sovereign identity. It's not Aries specific, but it's a great way to understand DID-based, DID fundamentals. Sounds like exactly what you're interested in.
Yeah, I've been going through these YouTube videos of SSI Meetup. So,
excellent. I'm glad you already found them. Very good. The other resource then you'll find, we do two calls. This one is meant to overlap with our European colleagues. We have another Aries Working Group B call that happens in the afternoon U.S. time. And that's a weekly call. This one's every other week because the overlap time period is harder to get time. Okay. But the Aries RFC GitHub repo is where you find the detailed discussion of all these different standards we've been talking about.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Excellent. So welcome. Anybody else want to introduce yourself? Okay, we'll move on then. A couple announcements. The Hyperledger, well, the Hyperledger has a working group for inclusivity, diversity and civility. They, at the Global Forum, they said that they still looking for survey responses. They want to get a better sense of what experiences people in our community have, and so we can identify if there are problems and ways we can, you know, you can always be a more welcoming community. So we want to do that, always improve. And of course, we're already talking about IAW at the end of April. I'm really looking forward to it. It sounds like I'll be able to go, assuming California still allows conferences because of the pandemic, or, you know, seeing how that goes. But I'm still planning on going. We'll see how that shapes up.
Richard, I've heard from Kalia that it will happen in one form or another. So if it doesn't happen in person, we will figure out a way to do it remote.
That's great news. And that makes a lot of sense. That, even better if I can sleep in my own bed and still associate with everybody. That'd be interesting to see how we do an unconference format remote. Thanks. That's a good update, Sam. As we mentioned, we have the other Aries Working Group call. You can see the agenda in the wiki. Sam, what's the plan for today? Do you?
Bunch of data exchange stuff, including signed attachments. There'll be some update on the ACK versus continue stuff. So an ACK message, but also the ability to continue to reuse a connection, and updates on the out of band stuff as well.
Excellent. So that'll be useful. So people who will be asleep during that call, you'll want to see the recording. We do pretty good about getting those. Sam does pretty good about getting those getting those added to the agenda page. And then a key chunk of what used to be Aries RFCs related to the lower layers of DIG communication have moved to the DIF working group for DIGCOM. And you can see the rolling agenda here. They've been making progress. Sam, you're, I think, our key person on those groups. How's that shaping up? I know the last time you reported, they were just getting organized. They started to make substantive changes to DIDCOM?
We have a lot of it's just sort of polishing and figuring that basic stuff out. We talked this last time about the common emerging pattern of initial values with a DID in a matrix parameter, and how that affects how we pass sort of initial DID docs and stuff like that. So there's parallel efforts going on within the Aries community, because we've got to make changes and move stuff. And then there's also those discussions happening in DIDCOM, and we anticipate those taking a little bit longer than the work in the Aries community. So there's some confusing parallel discussions, but it's what do we need to make happen now versus how do we want this to look in the future type of a difference.
Excellent. Thank you for that update.
Those calls are posted too in the rolling agenda, I don't have yesterday or Monday's up yet, but those are there, and you can listen to this if you're curious what's going on.
Very good, thank you for that. Very useful update. Sergey, Alex, some of you that I know are in Europe. Any questions for Sam about DIDCOM? Excellent. Work updates, just for people's information. I was looking for Daniel Bloom. I know there's continued progress on the test suite. On the indie calls, we've been having a lot of conversations around the area shared libraries. Obviously, Mike's going to give us an update on the KMS today. But the BC Gov team has made a lot of progress on the indie VDR and indie credex. Mike's made a lot of progress on the Aries credex. The Evernym team is looking to contribute on both of those and reviewing pull requests and helping make changes. So that's that update. If anybody, unfortunately, appears that the recording failed on the last, on Monday's Indie Contributors call, but you can see the notes in the wiki and you can monitor that on GitHub. I'm happy to answer any questions people have. As usual, people are making progress on the other projects. I have to say, Sam, a member of my team that attended the, I think it was the BC Gov demo on our training day at the Hyperledger Global Forum, his response was, the Aries toolbox is the coolest tool. He loved it. So I think that's kudos to your team for building it.
Thank you. Thank you. Cool stuff coming up in the future, but I will not explain it all just to leave you with anticipation.
Excellent. We're looking forward to that Christmas day of seeing the new toolbox, but it's a very cool tool. Anybody who has worked on Aries agents and has not played with the toolbox, you really ought to, because it's a great set of knobs for developers to get a sense of how an agent's working. Anybody else want to give an update on your Aries related project?
I will mention that the toolbox is young, and if you would like to use it with your projects but are having struggles figuring out why, please reach out. We have no misconceptions that it is perfect and done. So please do reach out.
Excellent. Anybody else excited to give an update about your part of the project? Okay, we'll move on then. Let's talk about connection reuse. I had Sergey's name down here because I didn't know who on my team would do it. Who's going to talk about connection reuse? So I'll stop sharing.
Okay. And yeah, actually, we ask Darko as a legend of to join our call and share his thoughts here. So Darko, please welcome.
Okay. I don't have anything to share. I didn't prepare anything, but I may talk about this feature. So the basic idea was to allow people to reuse existing connection, and in a web user, this may be problematic. So how it is done is when connect.me or client side detects that it already have a duplicate connection, it won't accept a connection request, but it will send a message saying that previous connection already exists. And in that message, it will also send some details about previous connection and signature, so that a requested party can find that connection and use the old connection for future requests.
When it's getting a connection request, how does it identify that there's another connection that's the same?
Yes, well, it can identify it only if the public DID is present. So obviously, because connections are anonymous in a way, if no public DID is present, then it cannot detect that they are a duplicate.
What message does it respond with?
It responds with a redirect message, which is very similar to access message, except it have another state and also provides some more details for redirection.
Okay, so our plan is to have what we call the continue. So could you share the attributes and the data in that you've got in that, because we haven't defined the continue message yet. So continue or whatever it should be called will be added to did exchange at least, possibly connections, and we'll do what the new message you've got has defined. So we'd love to know exactly what it looks like. So if you could share that, that'd be great.
Yeah, Well, like I said, I don't have anything prepared. So sorry because of that.
Yeah, if just Rocket Chat or something, that'd be great.
And that's okay. Under discussion for the call on later today. So if you have any text or anything that you can copy and paste into Rocket Chat, that would be very timely helpful.
Okay. I'll prepare something. It will be probably some short message, but we may talk on Rocket Chat if you need more details.
This is the pull request where that stuff was added. It's pull request 2080 to Indie SDK. Do you happen to remember which file the message would be in, Darko?
Sorry, not from top of my head.
Yep. That's fine. But you can see
only 45 files were changed, so it should be easy to find.
Yeah. Now, a chunk of those are the dummy agent for testing, which...
I'm sure of that.
Yeah. So, you just got to filter through 20 or so. My biggest finding of the Hyperledger Global Forum is that the dummy agent is no longer dummy agent. ABSA has contributed back full agent backend functionality to this, so we should probably change the name at some point. But...
Hey, I find some structure about collection direct details. Could you double check? Is it the right place to take a look? It's in Dummy Cloud Agent, but I think it should be the same in both.
Yes, this should be redirect details which are attached to a message, which is essentially the same message as except other than status, different statuses. Implemented. So if you go up, I think it's over there, internal message. I'll try to paste that into Rocket Chat.
Yeah, I mean, we just need to look at what the message looks like. That's really all we need. So that'd be awesome if you can find that.
Sure.
And from the looks of this, it looks like it's the did doc plus the signature.
Yes, essentially they have only pairwise DIDs, where key public DIDs and signature.
Okay. Cool, thanks.
Probably one more thing that should be mentioned here, that these libvstx changes are associated with old set of protocols, old Avenue proprietary-based protocols. So it's not a part of Aries support inside libvcx. So I think from libvcx future point of view, we could have some general API call, which will internally be split in two ways, in two paths, one for already existing one implemented by Darko for this collection direct, and for Aries flows, we can use outbound RFC with some maybe different nuances and details.
Thank you, Sergey. Thank you, Darko. Any other questions or comments about the connection reuse change to libvcx? Okay, excellent. We were, as I mentioned, our goal was to get an RFC submitted for this. Instead of doing that, we'll just work with the out-of-band protocol to make sure that there's a clear path forward for us. For the work you've done, Stephen, and we'll collaborate with you on that. That reminds me, Sergey, Stephen asked if you'd been able to review the out-of-band protocol RFC. Have you been able to look at that yet?
Not in details at all.
Okay. So that is on our list. We'll try to get that reviewed soon, Stephen. Okay, so with that, let's let Mike share his screen and let's talk about the key management service.
There, helps when they come off mute. All righty. So I know everybody's being quarantined and has nothing better to do, so I fully expect all of you will have understood this perfectly. But anyway, there's been lots of talk about how keys should be stored and then just building, I don't know what we're calling them now, what lockers, data vaults, the whole wallet experience type thing. So KMS might be a little misnamed. We can bike shed over that later. But the point of this RFC is to show kind of a more secure way to store agent stuff, keys especially. And so here's the RFC in the Aries repo. So it's taking the concepts that I proposed in locks and then expanding it to say, here's how keys should be managed and the other data could be managed depending on how you want to do this. And so how I've broken this down is overall, you can think of there's three components to this. There's the top part, locks, that I proposed earlier, which handles authentication and maybe the storage of kind of the top level credential, whatever that is, to open up everything else. So those might be keys, those might be usernames, passwords, whatever. Locks should be responsible for handling just that. And if your service is like Auth0 or something like that, it could handle the OAuth and OpenID Connect, whatever it is. And then where the keys should be managed is a component called the Enclave, whatever that is for you. It could be a hardware-backed piece of equipment. It could be a soft HSM, a virtual HSM, an SGX for Intel, or whatever the case is. That does all of your crypto and key management stuff. And then you store everything else in what I'm calling the persistence layer. Again, these names are subject to change. Enclave, I'm going to fight hard for that name because that's a pretty leading industry standard, but the rest of these, not so much. So that's how it, that's how I divide it. And so if you think what would go in each one, the Enclave's solely responsible for any cryptographic operations and keys. So generation, encryption, signatures. If you need to do key exchange, you could also have it do proofs. So for verifiable credentials, if you needed it to, you would have to pass the verifiable credential data in here and then combine that with any keys the Enclave might need to produce a proof. The Enclave can spit that out. That's actually pretty typical with how Enclaves do attestations. So that's not an unheard of scenario to do it that way. And then with the persistence, these are things I could think of that would go in there, like your verifiable credentials, maybe some protocol states that you might have if you're using noise or any DIDCOM related stuff that could go in there, DIDDocs, other metadata, whatever. That could go in here, and this might be broken out into however many layers designers might want. But the point is, I'm just encapsulating that as an overall concept. And then as described, locks handles who is talking to the outside clients. Any access control to these might be enforced in locks. And locks will handle connecting to any enclave or enclaves that are under the hood and persistence and making that opaque to the outsiders. And locks might choose to store some of that stuff in OS key rings or grab bags, you know, Amazon KMS, whatever the case is. So the point is, locks is the upper layer that can be used to talk to everybody else. So you connect to locks using, could be a USB, networked, physical devices, could be physical library calls, whatever the case may be. But its whole point is to handle the authentication, the access control, and possibly any auditing you might want. You can break it down and just say, this is our locks layer, and that's what it handles. I did a pretty big detail if you're going to use passwords to log in and how you should do that. Definitely look at password hashing that are specialized for that purpose. PBKDF2 is the only one approved by FIPS at this time, and it's quite old. And so it by today's standards, it's not immune to GPU attacks. And so I know NIST is looking to approve an alternative, and I'll go over that one in a second. But if you are forced to do NIST, PBKDF2 is your only option. And so I've given some recommendations about that. Bcrypt is another one. The only downside to Bcrypt is your passwords can't be longer than 72 bytes. So I know many of us have passwords longer than that. So sorry, if you're going to use Bcrypt, then you can't go longer than that. Scrypt is the one that NIST is looking to approve because fundamentally it uses pieces of PBKDF2 under the hood, and it is hardware resistant. So, you know, GPU ASIC and FPGA attacks. So you could use that one. But if you're looking for the one I recommend, it's called Argon 2. It won the password hashing competition. And I'm not going to go into all the details about how it works, just that that's the one I recommend if you can afford to do it. And the only problem with password hashing is if you choose to do that, if the parameters change based on the platform and hardware you're running on, typically, because you might have some settings for Argon 2 on your desktop and different ones for your server and different ones for mobile devices. And if you're wanting reasonable response times, you typically have to scale it down on the mobile device, but then that means it runs really fast on a more powerful machine. So if you can avoid using usernames and passwords and use something else like a biometric or a key that someone can use, that would be better, which is why in the locks RFC, I talk about storing those in keychains and then using biometrics, however the OS accesses those to do that. But regardless, once you're in locks, once you've been authenticated, locks, for example, could use the OS key ring to store the enclave credentials for the user or the persistence layer. So the client logs in, and locks pulls out the OS keyring credentials. And the only way locks can get access to the keyring is if it prompted the user for whatever that system might be and any constraints that are required to pull those out. And then it can go talk to any enclaves that your wallet needs to get access to. And in the enclave, you only store keys and the access controls surrounding those keys. And I'll describe those in a second. And then data persistence, how that's sorted is when you encrypt data, you also store the metadata about how it's protected. So what the key ID was used to encrypt it, and then maybe what algorithm was used to protect it. So this has the advantage of if you need to change your algorithms on the fly, you know exactly how the data was protected, and this doesn't leak anything. It's okay if an attacker knows how you protected it and even what key it was. As long as they don't get the key, then they can't get the data, the plain text data. So that way, if you need to change crypto providers, you still know how it was protected, and you know how to roll it forward if you ever need to change things. So this is just another example of how you would log in if you're doing passwords. So anyway, I talk about how locks manages the connections to the enclave and persistence, but all of this is opaque to a user. And whenever a connection is closed, locks should make sure it wipes from memory any sessions and keys it might have cached in memory, so that in a secure way, so that if an attacker comes in from the side, that any lingering sessions that have been closed won't leak any of your confidential information. All right, so when we go into the enclaves or the KMS part of this, this can be, again, hardware or software based. And these are examples of things that you could do in an enclave. This is not an exhaustive list, but I've done my best to kind of write down all the operations I could think of for now. So you can think of generating public key crypto, symmetric keys. I'm not going to go through all of these, but take a look at those. These are things that your enclaves or your KMS portion might want to do. And when you name the keys or the algorithms, pick something that's consistent like this, which says this is the algorithm, this is the format of the signature, for example, these are the sizes of the keys I permit and the MGF and so on. So I'm proposing that key IDs just be UTF-8 string names. And then if you need to map those to some other thing under the hood, you can do that. But that way it keeps things simple. And in the enclave, I said you store keys, and these are operations that it could perform. But there's metadata about the keys that you should also store. So what I call attributes, constraints, and controls. So attributes just kind of describe what the key is, like its identifier. A key might have any number of aliases if you support that. So if you want to say, I'm going to share a key with somebody else, but you could give it an alias so that for logging purposes, you can track who was using the key versus just sharing a credential name. Labels, like this might be a user-friendly name if you're ever going to expose what the key is versus the actual identifier, which might be a GUID or some more complex thing. The class is maybe the type of key it is, like if it's a public key, a private key, an encryption key. Tagging is just maybe for searching purposes. Type is what kind of crypto does it do? So I could have a public RSA key and a private RSA key, for example. The size in bits is just mostly for space purposes, if you want to be able to say that. Who created the key? When it was created? If it's allowed to even be updated? When was it last updated? Now, here's some permissions that might be new to you. And I'll go over these in the constraints, in the control section. So we always consider keys to be sensitive, so this might seem a little funny that it says always sensitive. But in the Enclave hardware world, when we mark a key as sensitive, it means that the key is either never allowed to leave the Enclave in the first place, or if it is, it must be encrypted or wrapped by another key. And the reason this always sensitive could be important for your auditing purposes is when you create the key, if you didn't set the sensitive flag to be on in the first place, then this will be false. And then when you do an attestation, you can't prove that the key was always in the enclave or always sensitive. Some auditors may ask for that. So that's what that flag is for. Now, never exported means obviously it has never left the enclave. I've never asked to export this key for backup purposes or for redundancy, high availability reasons. Derived from might be something, some enclaves support deriving keys from passwords, believe it or not. And so this might be the metadata surrounding that. But anyway, that's kind of the metadata attributes with keys. And then access constraints, many enclaves and like Mac and iOS do this, where you can specify this key is only allowed to be used by its owner if the owner has authenticated with Touch ID and or a passcode. So you can build constraints around how those keys are accessed using and or conjunctions and any number of these constraints. You can say, how fresh was it? When was the last time they actually authenticated? They can only use this key if they actually authenticate within the last 10 minutes with a biometric and or a passcode. So that's the point of constraints. Many modern enclaves and HSMs support this. Virtual HSMs, for example, may not. I know HashiCorp doesn't and can't tell because it's completely network-based, so this may not apply to all cases. But if you're down in the hardware or at the edge, you should consider using these. Access control surrounding keys. So these are permissions that you can set around what keys can do and what they can be limited to do, or capabilities might be another way of thinking of this. So if I have a key exchange key, maybe I might use it just to derive other keys. I may not use it for a key agreement. So that's kind of the difference here. I may want to have a key that can only decrypt things, and you'll see why when I talk about wrapping and unwrapping. So you might say, well, what's the difference between wrapping and unwrapping and crypt and decrypt? Well, usually they use slightly different algorithms for protection, but the main reason is when you go to export, there's certain types of leaking attacks that happen if you're not careful. So for example, a common case that this Cluo guy did was he set a key that can wrap and can decrypt. So he was able to say, okay, export a private key, and then I can use another key to decrypt and use the same key to decrypt it. So you want to be careful that that can't happen, because even though it was marked sensitive and exportable, so the key could only leave when it was wrapped, but because another key in the same enclave was allowed to decrypt it, that's a bad thing. So you have to be careful with your permissions and how you want to control handling exporting keys. Now, in an ideal world, we would never allow keys to leave an enclave. But given we need to deal with high availability and recovery or backups, that's not always ideal. So take a look at these. These are the most common access controls I could find. You might think of ones I don't have in this list, and if you do, feel free to submit a PR to add them. But I believe these are the 15 that most of you will have and want to use. In fact, you may not want to use all of these, but you may want to, you should at least consider those. Now, when you're exporting keys, some enclaves let you do what's called templating. And the reason you do that is when you export a key, you should take all of its access controls with it. So any metadata that it has, you should make sure that when you're importing it into another enclave that it honors those access controls and constraints. Otherwise, you may not want to let it leave. And it's important that when you create the key that you also create it with its access controls right up front. And so that way, when you're going to use the key, it can detect what access controls it's supposed to honor. Because, for example, when you're exporting keys, if you don't use a key that can wrap or unwrap, then that could be a problem. And then by then it's too late, because when you go to export the key, you don't want to change the permissions about that key when you're exporting it. You need to change it before then. So by the time you export it, it should just keep the same access controls and constraints that it currently has. So you don't need to say, when I'm exporting it, change it to be this. That's always been a bad thing. So this is the better practice to do it this way. Anyway,
Mike,
here's some, yeah.
Could I ask, can you scroll back? I was thinking about export. So I'm two scenarios I'm thinking about export and wanted to check if these are the types of things you're thinking of. One would be if you export the contents of your storage, of your persistence, presumably you would create a key inside the enclave, encrypt the data, export that, and then export the key used to create it. Is that an example of that?
That's one way to do it. The better example, or the better way to do it, is wherever it's going to, have that enclave create a public key that you can then import into this enclave and say, this can wrap, and that's all it can do. And then have that encrypt the data you're going to send over.
Okay, good. And then the second one is I was thinking of a link secret. Would that be managed as a key in the same as this, and therefore possibly you would make it exportable?
You could view it that way. I don't view it as that sensitive that it needs to be in the enclave. But you could treat it like a key. The only thing is, what would you do with it? The only thing it could probably be used for is when I say a test, that's basically a proof presentation.
Okay.
That would probably be all it would be used for. or maybe it's exportable.
So a link secret's really just a piece of data as opposed to a key.
Right.
Okay. Cool.
Any other questions before I move on?
Mike, so you've come up with this from surveying existing HSMs and what their attributes and functionality are. And so you're proposing that we reuse existing HSMs?
If you can, yes. So I'm trying to reuse what industry leaders have already proposed. And so this isn't a radical departure from that. There are some things that they don't have in this list that apply to every enclave. Like, for example, is synchronizable. This really only applies to OS keychains or OS-backed hardware ones. So Windows that detects a TPM, you can mark some keys as synchronizable, meaning me as a person, I have two laptops or two Windows devices with two TPMs. And if I mark it as synchronizable, then the operating system will automatically sync the keys between the enclaves in a very secure manner. Now, they don't go into what exactly that manner is. They just say secure. iOS is another one where, you know, your iPhone has a secure element. And if you mark a key as synchronizable, it will allow it to be copied to your cloud in an encrypted form. And then your other iPhone is allowed to decrypt it when it pulls it down. So that's something to be aware of. But that doesn't apply to HSMs, for example. So I have tried to not invent anything new, if that's what you're saying.
So, right. And so in order to take advantage of this, do we in the Aries community need to write new code or anything like that? Or if there's an existing thing that knows how to do encrypt, decrypt, wrap, unwrap, or are we needing to write a bunch of new code that goes into one of these?
You shouldn't need to write too much new code to account for this. Maybe the access controls you might if you've already implemented some wallets. And that if you already have existing implementations, hopefully you can start to adopt some these new principles that will help make your wallets more secure. Because you may not have these already in place. I know some of you don't, but that's okay. The point is, here is a new guideline in moving forward to protecting your keys and your data. So you might have to write new code, yes. But I think it's for the better of, you know, as a community, we can say, hey, here's the guidelines that we take when we're protecting data and keys, and this can be looked at and go, oh wow, they've really thought about this, and these are good practices.
One last question, then I'll let you get on with the rest of the presentation. Is there a significant difference between a hardware and a software enclave that we need to be aware of?
Yes. So the biggest thing is hardware enclaves are typically memory restricted, in that they can only store so many keys and only certain types of keys, and the operations that they can do are very limited. So Yubico, for example, supports just doing encryption, decryption, and signatures. That's about all it does. And Mac's Secure Element only supports NIST curves keys in the secure element. It doesn't even support RSA keys anymore. Many of them don't due to the size and how expensive they are to create RSA keys. You can store arbitrary things. Some of the enclaves let you store arbitrary data in there that's protected by a key in the enclave, which I find kind of silly. You should probably just say encrypt this and they'll store it outside the enclave. So with hardware, you tend to be a little more restricted, but at the same time, because it is hardware, then you've now separated the keys from the actual system itself. And so if you ever, an attacker that gets access to your wallet, if he doesn't have the HSM, obviously he can't do anything. So makes it a clear distinction between where those keys are used. And the other thing is, it's a lot harder to get access to the keys and sniff them and leak the keys when they're in hardware versus software. So those are the major differences. Those lines are starting to blur a little bit as we get into like SGX or Trust Zone or some of the other trusted execution environments. But anyway. Any other questions before I move on? Okay. So in the persistence layer, I just talked about enclaves, which were mostly just keys. Then the persistence layer can be wherever you guys want to store your data. So like a SQL database is a common thing. Could be a document database or MongoDB, whatever the case may be. But the point is you don't put keys in the persistence. That's the enclave's job. Now, persistence just stores, operates on encrypted data, or in the case of BCGov, I know you guys have public credentials, and so you may not want to encrypt those credentials. You may just want to integrity protect the credentials, and that way you could do plain text searches over them, but you can also detect if an attacker has modified them or tampered with them in any way, which should speed up things. Then the other thing to consider with persistence is, does the query engine operate over encrypted data, or does it operate, does it have the power to decrypt the data itself and read it? And there's a performance trade-off with that. And I've listed some numbers here from a very respected cryptographer who researches this stuff called structured symmetric searchable encryption and how to avoid access pattern leakage and that kind of stuff. So something to consider. I'm not saying one way is better or worse than the other, because it depends on what you're using it for. But in the persistence layer, these are the threats I can think of that you should consider. So as you're searching over the data, does an attacker have access to memory? Obviously, if they have remote access to memory, that's bad, obviously. Or they can look at how much data is stored. That's what the volume is. What data is being accessed, how it's being sorted, and other side channel attacks, you know, Rowhammer and timing attacks. Those are pretty difficult to deal with. Spectre and Meltdown, and now there's even more. So LVI that just came out yesterday. And what kind of adversaries are you designing for? So what are your security guarantees that you're looking for? And those are what you should design the persistence layer to protect it, to ensure. So the biggest thing is, when I talked about, you know, does the query engine have access to search over encrypted data, or can it decrypt the data itself and search? So you have application versus database decryption. So, or encryption. So at the application layer, the application encrypts the data before it puts it in there, and then only it's allowed to read the decrypted ciphertext, and the database just searches over encrypted data. And then there's database encryption like SQL Cipher, for example, which the query engine can decrypt it, but the keys are protected through some other means. And so something to consider. They're both, in terms of performance, I would say database encryption is slightly faster, because like in Postgres's case, you actually pass it the key. It decrypts the column as it searches and returns you the plain text results and then forgets the key. So you might say, oh, that's horrible, because now I just gave the database my key. Well, it's only there for a couple of seconds and then it's cleared securely from memory, but then there's the plain text coming across TLS. So, and that's interesting. All right, so moving on, because I'm about out of time and I'm just about done. You also may want to have constraints, like who's allowed to access this row of data in my database and what context is it allowed to be used. I might say I'm only allowed to present this credential under this context. I talked about the crypto protection around that piece of data, which is the key ID and what algorithm was used. So so you can have the flexibility of changing the crypto engine and without breaking your data. you might want to say, this data is never allowed to leave the KMS. It's a read-only piece of data, and it's going to be enforced. I can never delete it, or maybe this credential expires, and so I just want it to enforce that it will never work after this date. And then reference implementations, obviously Indy Wallet does part of this, but Indy could adopt, for example, the crypto protection surrounding its how it encrypts its data to move forward, and I don't think that would be a lot of work to do that. And one I'm kind of working on is called MyAguess. And I'm not quite done with that yet, but when I do, I will let you guys know about it. So with that, I am done, and hopefully you all understood everything. But otherwise, any questions?
Thank you, Mike. It's excellent RFC. And I'd like to come to go back on the topic around credentials, I mean, Anarchat's credentials and so on. So probably if we are talking just about user credential, it's not so sensitive and it can be used and it can be stored in persistent data, not in the enclave. But what do you think about issuer side? So if we are talking about issuer keys for anoncreates, for example, for Community Lysianska anoncreates and their signatures, do you expect to have it stored in enclave? And if so, what do you think about the process of signature? Because those signatures are not so trivial. And does it mean that we have to implement, for example, software enclave, which should support sign operation, kind of sign operation for CL signatures?
That's what I'm proposing, yes. That you have, like I said, the enclave doesn't necessarily represent this can only be one component. This could have some hardware-backed subcomponents, right, to do some of the operations. And then anytime you're involving keys, I would suggest we designate that as that's an enclave operation. And you're right, those signatures are not as straightforward. In fact, they might even be thresholdable, you know. But anytime there's keys, that's where it should be done in the enclave. And that way the persistence can be any data from persistence can be fed into the enclave to perform that attestation or signing operation. Because most of the time it's the keys that are more sensitive than the data that's in the persistence layer.
Okay, thank you for this clarification.
So for instance, Mike, with the components of a credential definition, those would be stored where and how would they be used?
So the cred def, there's like, you know, the ID of it and all the other stuff that's non-key, that's not a key, would be in the persistence layer. And then I would store the actual signing key in the enclave itself. The public key could probably just be stored in the persistence layer because it doesn't leak anything. It's just a public piece of data anyway. Doesn't have to be encrypted. In fact, it's not encrypted. It's on the ledger. So if you even want to store it at all, you could just put it on the ledger. But I would put everything but the private key of the cred def in persistence. And then the private key I would put in the enclave.
So the idea is you've got a reference to the private key in the persistence. And yes. Then when you go to sign a credential, all the data passes into the enclave and gets processed.
That's right. So okay. use the key ID, which I'm suggesting is just the UTF-8 string name. However, yeah. You want to format that is up to you. And some enclaves only take integers. like Yubico, for example, only takes integers. Mac only takes C strings, but I'm saying do UTF-8 and then convert according to whatever you need behind the scenes.
And when you say you really mean Aries, like the people who make the Aries shared library. Like this isn't going to be up to developers that are using Aries to do anything with. This is up to the people who build Aries to use, right?
Correct. Yeah, this is for the Aries developers. That's right.
As opposed to the app developers that are building on Aries. Okay.
Right. I would hope the app developers just say, oh, I just need this, sign this credential, and they don't know anything about it other than,
right,
here's the cred def ID, sign this, you know?
Yeah.
Any other questions?
I'll go with one more. So my understanding of how Indie works, Indie Wallet, is that basically there are protected keys that handle the encryption, and then everything else, including the private keys of like DIDs and credential definition, are in the encrypted database. Is that correct?
I'm not the best person to answer that question.
So if you're trying to give to map this RC to current Indie Wallet implementation, current Indie Wallet is something like Enclave. It never allowed to leave the private key of the ID outside without encryption. And the kind of difference here that for credential definition, for private keys of credential definition, we allow to fetch the private key, and then this private key goes to URSA and used in signature. So it's one of
the
drawback of current implementation.
Well, in a way, that's basically like an enclave, because it's not returning it to the outside world. I mean, that's the idea of the enclave, is that the key will, unless it's exportable, will never see the light of day outside of the enclave itself. So if there's underlying libraries it has to pass it to, that's one thing. But as long as it doesn't move up, that's usually what I mean by, unless it's exportable. And then there are certain controls around that. So I believe the Indie Wallet is very much like an enclave, but it's also storing, it has a flexible persistence layer that kind of blurs the line between these two.
Yeah, got it. Thank you.
Mike, are you planning an initial implementation of an enclave? For your
yes, I'm actively working on one. That's the Ares Mayaguez, is it's just going to initiate. Campara is doing the persistence layer of that, and I'm just doing the enclave part. And they can be broken apart. So if you just want my enclave code, that's fine. I'm currently storing things in the OS keychain as much as possible. And if there, I can detect a TPM or a secure element, I'll store as many keys in there as I can. So that's what I'm doing, but others may have other things that they may want to use for the back end.
And the whole thing's designed to be pluggable so that other people can plug in different implementations of persistent storage, for instance.
Right. Yeah, and because I'm doing it in Rust, this is just a compile time thing to say, I just want the OS key ring and nothing else, because I don't want to have to deal with trying to do discovery on a USB thumb drive, Yubico key, or F-Secure key, because those are too much of a pain to deal with. So.
Well, thank you, Mike, for giving us insight into your thinking on this and seeing the progress you're making. There's a lot to digest there. I'm going to be really interested to see how we can evolve Indie's wallet to move to incorporate a lot of this stuff. And of course, seeing your progress on Mayaguez will be really interesting. So thank you for that. If any people have other conversation, other topics they want to discuss on this, other questions, then we'll move that to Rocket Chat. And with that, we're at the hour, and I'll get the recording posted soon. Thank you, everybody.
Thanks, bye.